Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome again to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. And I guess I'm in the warm section of the country with it being 37 degrees. That's warmer than it is everywhere else, I think. Well, the three of us, anyway.
We need to get Bobby a snowsuit or something.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get him some snowshoes for his birthday. I want to quote him from the L.L. Bean or something.
I look like the Abominable Snowman or something.
If nothing else, I'll buy you a couple of tennis rackets and you can use
I heard that.
Get him a sled or something.
He's got a nice front yard. He could probably sled right there.
Yeah, well, I slid down it in my truck 3 or 4 weeks ago.
It's not a bad winter. I feel for those people in the Midwest. I was reading today that the Iowa and parts of Illinois and all that, they've already gotten hammered with footloads of snow, not inches, but feet of snow, and they're looking at another 18 to 20 inches within the next couple of days.
So. The company that I work for, our corporate headquarters, is in Chicago, and I was on the phone with a guy the other day, and I asked him, I said, how's the weather? And he was telling me he had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to clean off his driveway because they were expecting 2 more feet of snow, and he knew if he didn't get out there and clean it up then that it would just be he wouldn't be able to do it. And I said, you're telling me you get up at 4:30 in the morning to shovel snow? And he said, yes. And I said, may I remind you, Delta is ready when you are.
Oh. I can't imagine. I cannot imagine. Well, guys, this week I want to talk about, again, we are always constantly talking about subjects about things that seem to no longer exist in the business and outside of Mexico and people, independent groups, and one guy in on the national scene, there doesn't seem to be any more mask wrestlers, and that was a thing that, love it or hate it, back in our day was a given. It always seemed like, you know, every territory you went in, there was somebody working at or near the top. It was a mask wrestler, and there have been literally hundreds of great ones over the years. And I worked under Hood, Bobby. I know you did from time to time. Jared, did you ever work under a mask at any point in your career?
I wore one time in Atlanta. TV. I thought I was going to smother.
It's like wearing a fishbowl on your head, isn't it?
I tell you, I respect those guys that did it. I couldn't have done it. Can't. It's obvious I wasn't used to it. You know, I couldn't breathe right, and then my vision was... You know, it was miserable. How those guys did it, I don't know.
I hated it all for those same reasons. But my biggest thing about hating was, you know, one of the reasons I got in the business was to meet women, and you can't pick up girls wearing a mask on your face. It's just not possible.
In your case, Michael, it might not have been a bad move.
That's true too.
Listen,
when I didn't wear one, I could get them to talk to me. They wouldn't even talk to me when I was wearing one.
You know, the thing with the mask is too. It depended on what kind of material it was made out of. You know, as the mask evolved over the years, the material got lighter. It got where you could breathe through it. I'll tell you a guy that I respect to this day for the mask he wore was Joe Hamilton, the Assassin. They wore that heavy silk, and one time in my illustrious career, I went and wrestled as an assassin because they had him double booked. Me and Randy Cully were partners. And I'm going to tell you, I thought I was going to die before I got out of that thing.
Yeah, those things laced up the back, too.
Yes, sir. And, buddy, they were skin tight, and you couldn't – I mean, it was just – they were so thick, there was no way that the – you know, the heat evaporates at the top of your head, and in that hood, there was nowhere for it to go, so it stayed in there.
I don't know how him and Tom did it all those years, and with those outfits they wore.
Oh, yeah. And it didn't matter if you were in a farm center and it was 109 degrees, they wore that whole outfit.
I don't know how they did it. I guess they got used to it, I guess.
I guess.
I didn't want to take that.
The one I had to wear, it was made out of whatever that nylon, Dacron, whatever the trunks back in the 70s and 80s were made out of, that polyester material. The mask I wore was the same thing, but it was one of those that just had the drawstring that you tucked under, and I hated the thing where the seams were. You know, it puffed up because I kept, at that time when I was wearing it, I kept my hair cut short. Otherwise, my hair would work into my eyes through the and cover up the eye holes, and I couldn't see. So I kept my hair cut short, but even so, that mask never did fit right, and where those seams went across on either side of your head, it stuck up. I looked like Batman. And, you know, Johnny Walker always wore those K&H masks, and so did Tim Wood, and Miss Olivia made masks for everybody else, made some beautiful masks. And why in the world, I guess he was just sticking with the tradition and wore those old $2 K&H
ones. He loved those K&H masks. He just, they fit him. I mean, me and him had that conversation a couple of times, and he said he just liked the way that's what he started out with, that's what he got used to, and he just never wanted to change.
Are they still in business?
I don't think so.
No, they are. They are.
Oh, they are?
I've been meaning to mention this for several weeks now. Jerry brought him up one of the shows we were talking about back at the end of last year. And just out of curiosity, I went on the web internet and looked them up. They are still in business, still there in Ohio, where they've always been. Still make, and I don't know why they make them because nobody wears them, they still make the Tarzan and Butcher tights the outfit, full outfits. Still make those, even though nobody wears them. The only thing I didn't see on their website, they don't make boots anymore and they don't make masks anymore. But they are still in business.
I don't even know why they don't make boots. Well, I can understand that.
No.
Nobody owns any anymore.
I never bought any of their boots, but
I never wore a pair.
The one I used to sell, they had slick bottoms on them. You'd kill yourself.
The first pair I ever bought, I bought from Carl and Hildegard. I paid $10 for them.
I never understood how guys would get in the ring with those bottoms on those shoes. They were like glass.
Yes, they were.
I don't know how the guys did it in those boots. I never could do it. I wore a pair one time.
The first thing I did when I would get them, before I'd ever even put them on, I would take them. I had a shoe shop there in Hayville, Georgia, not far from the Falcons Rest where the guys lived. And he knew what I wanted, and I'd take them down there, and you know, he'd put about 3/4 inch of it on the bottom for me. And I got a lot of wear out of them.
They sold a lot of boots in their day,
yes,
though.
Yes, they did.
White and black. When the first catalog I ever got, Norman Lawson gave me the only catalog I ever had from them. And they offered you white and black, and that was it. And you could get in just regular leather, patent leather, and they were, I guess the tops of them were 10 inches. And I was so tall, I wanted higher tops, so I ended up getting the only pair I ever owned and still own. I got from Noah Ash with 12-inch tops with the thick soles on them. That was another thing. I don't know how you could take a bump in those. You know, take like a backdrop or a body slam. The soles of your feet had to have been killing you in those thin-soled boots because there was no protection on them.
The last time I looked, don't think they wasn't proud of their trunks. I mean, they were outrageous. I forgot what we used to pay for those trunks. $12-15, something like that.
They were cheaper than that. They were $8 and $10 too at one time.
Yeah, I bought first purchase I ever made from. I bought two pair of butcher tights and one set of trunks.
Okay.
And one of the butcher tights was more expensive than the other one because it was two tone. It was black or blue in the back and white in the front. And I think those were 16, and the others were tights were the two sets of butchers were $15 for one, $16 for the other, and I think the trunks were $10.
I'll give them credit for one thing. They put out good merchandise.
Yes, they did.
There was quality stuff, I promise you. I've still got trunks that I've had for, I couldn't tell you how long. They still look brand new.
Did Jerry, you bought your boot. Didn't you get some boots you used to buy from the guy in Texas, didn't you?
Yeah, in Houston.
Yeah. I never got any from him. I had Ash make me a pair, and you brought me a pair back from Japan, Jerry. I got you to bring me a pair back one
you
time
sure
when
did.
You were going
you
to
sure
Japan.
Did.
And I had Abdullah. I had a pair of what I did with my boots, I always wore the toes out. Referee is sliding around on the mat, and I kind of prided myself on not just, you know, flopping down. I'd jump over a guy and take a little, you know, fall down and slide around, and I'd wear the toes out. So what I'd wind up doing, I'd have to take them to the shoe shop, and they'd put me a piece of leather across the toes so I could get more wear out of the boots. The boots would be in good shape, but the toes would, you know, be poking out. My toes would go out the end of them. So I took a pair of those boots, and I sent them with Abdullah to Japan. And he brought me a pair back that they made for me over there. But when they brought them back, they used the boots I sent as a pattern, and it had a piece of that leather over the toe. They made the boots with the leather already over the toes. And I don't know what kind of material they used on the cover that they put on the toes. I still got them boots back here in the closet, and they're as good now as it was the day I got them, and that's been 30 years ago.
Well, the guy in Texas, his name was Clifford. He's a Mexican guy. Had his shoe shop there and all. I had him to put shark skin on the toes of my boots.
Uh-huh.
Never wore them out ever. Never.
Hmm.
Never. Of course, you paid a little extra for that shark skin, but
it's worth it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know a lot of guys bought from him. I mean, they were not only a quality shoe, they were a good-looking shoe, too, man.
He'd make them any way you wanted them, any way you wanted them. And they were quality. I mean, quality boots. I don't even know if Clifford's still around anymore.
I haven't heard in years. I mean, like you say, nobody buys boots anymore, so I don't know, you know.
I'm wondering what a pair of boots from somebody like Noah Ash, because when I bought mine, if I'm not mistaken, I paid $35 for them. They're patent leather. And I think
I only bought one pair from him. I didn't like his boots. For me, I didn't like it.
The leather that he used compared to the boots that you were getting from Japan or from other places, the leather that Ash used was thick and it was stiff. The pair of boots that Abdullah brought me from Japan, I mean, they literally, you couldn't stand. I mean, you'd have to cement them to get them to stand up. When you set them on the floor, they just fall over. They're that soft. I've got a pair, the only two pair I've got left, I still got the pair that I bought from Ash back here, too. They'll stand just straight up because that leather is so stiff and thick. And you're right, Jerry. Compared to the other boots that I wore, they were not the most comfortable thing in the world.
And, you know, I had a pair of red leather boots. They wasn't patent leather. They were red leather that the guy in Houston made me. Those are the most comfortable pair of boots I ever. I could have used those for just walking around shoes. They were the most comfortable boots I ever owned.
Now, you always, or not always, but a lot of times you wore those vintage ones as well. You and Ken Lucas and I guess Steinborn were the only three I ever saw wear those.
Yeah, I still got a pair, and they're, I mean, honest to goodness, they look like they're brand new. And the guy in Houston made those for me. He made me several pair of those. I know when I was running a few years ago, you know, promoting, I was going to wrestle one night, and I pulled those boots out and put them on. And one of those guys, I noticed he kept staring at my boots. I had on real bright red socks under them, you know. He said, man, he said, I've never seen a pair of boots like that in my life. I said, well, thank you. That was the idea.
Ted had a pair that he wore, and I remember he was always on the lookout for thick, like hunting socks or something to wear under him.
Exactly right.
Because he always wanted something thick.
Ted always ordered pretty boots. He always had good looking boots.
But I guess.
Well, guys, getting back to our subject of mascots, we're going to have a guest with us tonight who probably. And I'd say it had to be neck and neck between him and Randy Colley as to who had the most mask gimmicks, and I'd probably give the nod to Curtis Smith, who's going to be our guest here. I'm going to dial him up. We've got a new feature on here on my switchboard, and everybody tells me it works, so I'm going to call him up here in a minute. But before I do that, I just look over here and notice a note. I mentioned last week about Oliver Humperdinck. They, on the biopsy that they did Friday, they found out he's got, cancer, and I guess it's either in his gallbladder or his kidneys. I'm not sure which. I read both. So I want just to keep our thoughts and prayers out for Red, because he's, like I said last week, he is just one of the most genuine, great people I've ever met in my life, and he's asking that everybody keep him in their thoughts and prayers, and I certainly want to do that.
That's for sure.
Anyway, let me try and get Curtis Smith on the line with us, who, for those who are not familiar with that name, because he worked most of, if not all of his career, under a mask. And once I get him on the line, I'll confirm all the names he used. We're going to hear the dial tone at this point. I apologize for that, but that's one of the little things on here. So, if I can rib him and tell him he's won $1 million.
Hello?
May I speak to Curtis, please?
Just a moment.
Thank you.
Hello?
Smitty?
Yes.
Hey, it's Michael from P-State Pandemonium. Got Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons on the line, on the air with us, too. You are now on the air on P-State Pandemonium.
Uh-huh.
And just wanted to welcome you to the show.
All right.
Let me get the rundown here. I know you worked all, if not most of your career under a mask. Let me see if I can, all the names I remember you working under. Of course, you were here in the Gulf Coast Territory originally as the Big Blue Yankee.
Mm-hmm.
And you also worked in here as the Spoiler.
Yeah.
As the Mighty Yankee with J.C. Dykes.
Right.
As one of the Infernos.
Uh-huh.
And the Challenger.
Yeah.
Like that's all that you did here. And in Georgia, you were the Infernos, you were the Super Infernos.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? You worked in Tennessee as the Executioner. Am I missing any?
Right. You hitting everything on the button.
I was just saying, it'd be a neck-and-neck race between you and Randy Colley as to who had the most mask in it.
Oh.
Did you two ever team up? Did you and Randy ever work together?
No, I don't think we did. Of course, I know I had different partners here and yonder, but no, I don't think I did. But that's been a long time ago to go back and try to remember.
Did you ever work anywhere for any length of time without a hood?
I went to Canada, and me and Roger Smith, we went up there, and then they needed a baby face there. So I came out from under the hood there and came in like I came in and started working baby facing. And that was in a country of where it was nothing at. So I didn't stay there all probably just a few weeks. I had to get out of there. I'd leave Calgary on like a early Monday morning and wouldn't get back to early Saturday morning.
I've heard of how bad Calgary was.
Yeah.
Jerry, you can relate to that, having worked for the Oklahoma territory.
Yeah, exactly. Curtis, this is Jerry Oates, man. It's a long time no see, man.
Yeah. Yeah, we spent a lot of hours in the ring.
Yes, we did, sir. Yes, we did. A lot of good hours.
Oh, yeah.
How you doing? Good?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm retired now from the fire department. Well, I had to retire. I had some injuries and everything, and some heart problems, and so I had to get out. I stayed on the fire department here worked my way up, made an officer, stayed on here about 18 years that I got in, and all of this here hit me. So I had to retire, everything. I had, two back surgeries and three heart attacks, and the last one I had five bypasses, but doing real good. When the weather's where I can get out, I walk about 5 miles a day, and at Monday through Friday, got a track over there, and I think if that track could tell you, the shoes were made for walking.
Well, you know, those back surgeries, Curtis, come from all those picking me up, slamming me all those years. That's
oh.
Got me back.
Well, I got a few myself. I mean, I had some rings up there. Well, in Mississippi, we worked on one side of the ring, especially the one in Meridian, because it was a boxing ring, and had a rod right down the middle of it, and we would try to just work on one side.
I know about those rings.
That wasn't the only one, but you know, we had a few in the business like that here and there. Then went to Japan over there, and my goodness, the ring over there was just like walking out here on the ground.
Curtis, you and Doug Gilbert teamed up together, right?
Right, uh-huh.
Where all did y'all go together?
Well, me and Doug was in here in Georgia, and then what happened to Doug. That's me, him, and J.C. Dykes. I'm trying to figure whatever happened to him after we departed and everything. I think me and J.C., we moved into back down on the coast there and picked up a guy named Mac McManus. And he worked as one of the Infernos, and went to out there in L.A. with him. But it didn't last long out there. Finally, I was going to Japan out there, and both of us. And J.C. Dykes, he didn't go. But when we come back, we departed from California and everything, got out of there. So Mac went one way and I went the other. Finally, I came back on the coast there and went in over there working for Frankie Kane for a little while. But they left there and went back into Mobile. Louis Tillette and then took the book over there, and then Louis commenced beating everybody. He was on top over there. So had this offer here in Carrollton, where I'm at now, at the fire department open. So I used to be on the fire department up in Tennessee before I got in the business. Then I heard that they had an opening, so I drove up here on the weekend, went in there, and seen the chief. He took me across the street to the city hall, and the city manager hired me right then, and I went back to Pensacola and loaded up and come back the following week and started to work at the fire department.
Did you ever wrestle any after that?
Yeah, I worked some with Ronnie West, some of his towns, and I worked Birmingham and just some spot shows here and there for him. And for the Atlanta office. I guess it was the Atlanta office, but he was in it, and I was working for him. But, yeah, I worked a few spots here and there for him. But I was on the fire department at that time.
So you've been in Carroll all those years.
Gilbert, with the Infernos, you teamed with, well, you replaced Frankie Kane teaming with your brother Rocky with your first
right,
team
uh-huh.
in the Infernos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I know you and of course, Gilbert, and one of the Von Brauners worked in there somewhere for a short time.
Yeah, Carl Von Brauner. When Frankie left, my understanding that they picked up Carl Von Brauner, and they worked in there for a while, and then they was fixing to leave, but Carl was retiring. He was fixing to move to California, and he was in the crop dusting, flying a plane, you know, the crop dusting. And he left, and they was pulling out of Charlotte, and the brother called me, wanted to know if I wanted to come in with them. And I said, well, sure. So I met them, I left Mobile and went into Tampa, Florida, and we teamed up there, worked down in there for the office there, Eddie Graham, Lester Welch, and we worked all around Florida and everything. Then we flew into the Bahamas and worked there a few times. And come back. Then when we finished up in Florida, well, we went to Amarillo. Worked out there for Dory Funk Sr. and his promotion. Stayed out there for a good while.
Heard they had some trips out there, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had some pretty good little trips out there. My Lord, we'd leave like on Sunday morning and drive to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and work. Well, we may go down on Sunday evening there and make a promo or something, but we'd work there in Albuquerque on Sunday night. Then after the matches, well, we'd drive to El Paso and stay in El Paso and work there to Monday night. But like I said, there were some long trips through there. I remember one night I went through some town, got on the other side of town and on top of a mountain, and you could see the town, and I could see a car coming way back down through there, and it was a policeman. He said, "Man," said, "I've been trying to stop you for miles," and I thought, "Well, my Lord, I ain't been driving that fast." He gave me a ticket, run me down and give me a ticket. Seemed like it's about 5, 6, 7 miles out of town, you know. You get up on that mountain, you look back down behind you, and you see all the lights and everything coming out of that town. I noticed the lights is coming way back behind me there. Finally, I stopped, here he comes. It was a cop, and he wrote me a ticket.
Did you enjoy that territory?
Yeah, in a way I did. It was different. Out in the land of the old West, like different colors and everything. In El Paso, shoot fire. It was just it's something different, you know, to work there. Even though the trips were long, but it just to me, it was just felt pretty good, you know.
I never worked Amarillo, so.
Uh-huh.
How many riots did you get in out there? I know the Infernos were notorious for, especially with Dykes.
Oh, Lord.
Exciting riots.
Good gracious. I don't know how many riots. I remember, well, when Frankie Kane, my brother and him worked there before I teamed up with him. I was told about this old woman that sat on ringside, and every time somebody, one of the guys she didn't like, come out, well, she's bad to throw stuff on them. So we worked over there, and we worked with Senior and El Santo, and did something. I forget right offhand what we done. Anyhow, we come out of the ring, and this old woman was sitting there, and all of a sudden she had a big old cup, and she just throwed it and hit Dykes right in the eyes. And man, it, I'll tell you the truth, when he got in the dressing room, it's a wonder he hadn't put them out. His eyes was burning just like it had acid in them. And, well, I got ready to go back to ring. I went to that old woman, and I went right up to her. The police was right beside me and everything. And I got right in her face. I told her point blank, I said, if you ever throw anything else on us, I said, I may go to jail, but I promise you one thing, I'll knock every tooth you got out of your head. And I tell you what, every time we went to the ring from there on, every what we done, she didn't do nothing. Boy, she was just like a little angel. But I told her, I said, I'll go to jail. I said, but I promise you, I said, I'll knock every tooth you got out of your head.
Did J.C. ever get stabbed?
Do what?
Did J.C. ever get stabbed?
I really don't know. I know J.C. got, you know, he got hurt different times there. We had so many people on top of us sometime, you know, we didn't even know what was going on. If one of these even going to get us to the dressing room or not. But I know J.C. had a hard time there, even things that he didn't even do, just sitting there. But, you know, always somebody there trying to jump on J.C.
But, you know, we've talked about this before, Curtis, but, you know, it takes a lot of guts for a guy to sit his back to all those people back in those days, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and especially right on top of the ring, the ringside right on top of you.
Oh, yeah.
And the law enforcement, they could care less about you getting hurt, nothing. They'd sit there and laugh about it, you know, and getting paid to protect you, but that didn't, for them, that was nothing. They didn't care, really. They didn't care what happened to you, you know. But we've had some dangerous things. We've been shot at, cut at, and all of that, bottle throwed, hit in the head, and all of that junk. But a lot of stuff, not only me, but a lot of guys.
Well, y'all shouldn't have been so nasty, Curtis. That wouldn't have happened.
Well, I'm telling you the truth, nasty. If we'd had a spoonful of sugar, that wouldn't have done no good.
He can't blame it all on Dykes either, because I personally, growing up, watched Smitty here in Mobile.
Yeah.
And he was right by himself, and it was funny. He wore that built-up shoe gimmick, and every time he'd tap his foot and he was going to load his boot, you'd look around, and there'd be 1,000 people in the audience standing up there hollering at the referee, tapping their foot. It looked like a bunch of people trying to win a dancing contest. Jumping around, tapping,
hey, I'm telling
the
truth,
referee
buddy.
What he's done.
I wrestled Bob Kelly down there. Oh, Lord. I don't know. Me and Bob, we broke the record there in Mississippi of houses of drawing anything. And we worked one day on TV, and he had took the boot off. And I told him, I said, well, I didn't need the boot to beat you. So went out, and I got bloody and come back. I was fixing to get in the ring, and the referee come in between us, and I jumped up. And Kelly was going to try to get me, and I slingshotted him. Both of them went back down, and I come in the ring, turn around right in front of the camera, and come out with the big old ball of fire you ever see. Oh, it seems to hurt my arm. I hit Bob Kelly with it. You talking about screaming. People in the audits, and even the commentator, he didn't know anything about it. So, boy, here he come. I just went ballistic, you know. But so I burned old Bob with the fire and everything, and got my boot back on top of it. You know, I still got that boot in here.
You should have it bronzed.
Yeah.
Curtis, this body's
in. I don't know. There's a bunch of guys on these message boards and everything. You probably, if you put it up on eBay, you probably get a couple $1,000 for it.
Oh, Jesus, tell me about it. Curtis, this is Bobby. I met you, first time I met you was in 74. And if I remember right, Don Green was your partner at that time. You and J.C.
Don
and Don Green were.
Yeah, he was another
partner.
Yeah.
But I told I've told this story, but you were talking about all the things that JC got into. You might remember. Do you remember when the lady hit him in the face with the fruitcake on Columbus TV?
I can't remember it offhand.
We were going home for Christmas, and we were coming back Christmas Day for a battle royal there in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And the deal, and remember, the TV was live, and
yeah,
the deal was they set it up. We had about 15, 16 guys in the ring running around as TV went off.
Right.
And he come running up to me. I was refereeing, and he come running up to me and hollered, "Punch me in the nose." And I went, "JC, I'm refereeing." And he said, "Hit me." And I hit him. And when he moved his hands, he was bloody. And
yeah,
as the ring cleared out, there was one of them 1-pound Claxton fruitcakes laying in the ring. And I just reached down, picked it up, and slid it inside my pants in my trunks. And when we got in the dressing room, he was back there trying to get his nose to stop bleeding, and he was talking about somebody that hit him with a brick. And I pulled the fruitcake out, but the lady hit him with a fruitcake down in Columbus. But changing streams here for just a second. Talk a little bit about JC. I've said this a lot of times. I don't know that I ever met a nicer guy.
Yeah.
In my years in the wrestling business, he was just a super guy. He was nothing like people thought he was. And
right.
I mean, we lost him way too soon. He was just a joy to be around, to listen to.
Just like I said, he was a super guy. And you know, everywhere we went, we dressed as business men, you know, suits and ties and everything. Even when we would come to the arena and leave from the arena and interviews, we would come like a big Philadelphia lawyer, they say. But, yeah, he was good, and he just write down, you know, just sit down and talk to you. He had a lot of, you know, knowledge, ring knowledge and everything, and they... When they picked him up, to be the manager of the Infernos and everything, him and Frankie, the three of them with the experience they had, they hit it off, and they went into Charlotte, and made the big time money there in Florida too, I believe. But he was just right down, you know, ordinary fella there, but he was you couldn't hardly beat him.
He was
top of the line.
He was a super guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was before you mentioned Florida and Frankie and Rocky. You remember Joe Powell, don't you? The referee who worked for
yeah.
me down here for so many mm-hmm. years. You know, when Frankie and Rocky and JC left Florida for some reason, they brought in Lee and Bobby Fields and
yeah.
put the Inferno outfits on them. Well, they brought in Joe. And he was supposed to go out with him. He dressed like JC. He was supposed to go out under a hood as well. So
uh-huh.
the fans would think, well, you know, this is JC wearing a mask. And he
yeah.
told the story the first night that he was supposed to do that. He got there and didn't have a mask. So he went out barefaced and just blew the whole gimmick. So they had to work out a deal, and they brought JC and Rocky and Frankie back in and beat the Fields and unmask them and run them out of the territory. So they were going to work a long program with them, and
yeah.
Joe messing up, forgetting that mask just blew the whole thing.
Yeah, there was I don't remember that guy. He was a long timer when I first started it with them. He rode with us somewhere. Well, during the when he got done his match and everything, and we was getting ready to come back, well, he was under the hood. The next thing we knew, he was out there and had his hood up. And he was talking on the telephone. People coming by and looking at him. I think they hollered at him. Finally, he pulled it down. And another time, me and Dykes and brother and this other guy. When I got in the car, they said, "Now, so hey, he's hard of hearing." Said, "When you talk to him, said you got to talk loud." So I didn't know they was trying to pull something over me. So when I said something, you know, they said, "Hey, he can't. You go have to talk a little louder." So when I was talking to him, I was about the top of my voice. And other than the guy said, "Hey," he said, "I'm not hard hearing." I said, "Well, make me look like a fool." Yeah, we went on down for miles, like, you know, talking, and said, "Hey, he can't hear you. You got to talk loud." And I talked about, all things, nearly hollering it out. The guy said, "Hey, I mean, hard hearing." Said, "My God," I said, "I heard everything you say." Hey, Leo Garibaldi, J.C. Dykes, one night, we worked Miami, Florida, so me and my brother was coming back, and J.C. was riding with Leo. So they was coming through about middle ways down there. So they were drinking and throwing beer cans out. So this police car, is it the police or sheriff's department or something, one of the law enforcement, pulled up behind them. And when they seen that, they was out taking, 10-100. Said when they seen that the police, you know, well, next thing you knew, they come and throwing the empty beer cans back into the car. They told that guy, said, "I don't know who done this, but we'll clean it up." They had a whole stack of beer cans. You know, they've been throwing them out now, coming down through the highway and everything. But when they stopped, got out and everything, well, they unloaded a whole sack of beer cans. And when that cop pulled in behind them, they seen who it was, they got out and started throwing the cans back in the car. Said, "I don't know who done this, but we'll clean it up."
Well, how long did it take you to get used to wearing a mask?
It was just a short time. I started out with Nick Gulas's territory. Me and Pepe Lopez, we started under the hoods up there. And I worked there. And then when I started there, I kept it on. And at that time when I worked Babyface, man, you're talking about somebody just completely messed everything, you know. Used to wearing that, then that's just like stepping into another body and being, you know, with the hood on and everything. So without it, I was just so lost. I couldn't even work without it. But put it on, I was like Jekyll and Hyde.
That's right. I forgot you and Pepe were the Blue Demons. That was another gimmick that you wore. I totally forgotten about that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, man, I don't know how you kept up with all of it.
Yeah, Lord. But Pepe, you know, I don't know when brother called me and said they had an opening in Mobile. I wouldn't know, and said they would bring you right in on top. I wouldn't know if I'd be interested in coming. And I said, "Well, sure." So I gave notice to Nick and finished up in Birmingham and then left there and came on down to Mobile and started that Monday night on the at the Gulf Coast there. And I had the hood and Billy Spears, they brought him in. So Spears and I worked as the Yankees, you know, Blue Yankees there for a good while. And he didn't care nothing about it. He wanted to come out from under the hood, you know. So finally they worked something and brought us out. But we went to Japan and back. But he didn't care nothing about working under the hood anymore. He doesn't get tired of it.
Here, I'll get them in.
Yeah, and you also did, I don't know if it was before Billy or after Billy, but Jimmy Hyde was also a Blue Yankee there for a little bit, wasn't he?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, me and Hyde worked together there, and over in Meridian, Mississippi, we did something, and, man, we filled up the ring. Finally, the chief of police and a couple of state troopers, they had some guy come in there, and his hand, they couldn't do nothing with him. His wrist was so big they couldn't put the cuffs on him. And Jimmy Hyde hooked him. And while they got the cuffs to put on his hands, they called the old guy named Scooter. And, boy, you're talking about some knockdown drags out. We had it, but they couldn't do nothing with this guy. And so Jimmy Hyde, he hooked him over there, and finally they got over to him and put the double cuffs on him and everything where they could handle him. But we have seen some times.
I can imagine so.
And I think one of the worst places was Fort Whiting. That was a rough place. Of course, we had some other places, but to me, that was the number one place right there. And, you know, trying to get back to the ring, back to the dressing room, everything. We majority of times, we'd fight our way back to the dressing room. And some of the fans was fighting. The deputy sheriffs and everything, when they come through the door, would get a hold of them and throw them back in and lock them up in the paddy wagon.
You know that old building's still there on Brooklyn Field, Fort Whiting?
I believe it is. I don't know for sure, but I got a feeling that
it is. They just recently, well, not recently, within the last 4 or 5 years, they renovated it. But it's still standing there, that great big old white building.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I used to drive by it every once in a while, cutting through the interstate to be back up, so I'd jump off and cut through Brooklyn Field trying to get to where I was going and pass right there in front of it. Well, as far as you, what was the decision on bringing you back in as the spoiler when you had been here for so long?
I'd been there so long and everything, and I went out, and I thought, well, I'll change something different, you know. I just thought it would sort of give the Yankee thing a rest a little bit, but you know, when people around, people like us in the business and the fans and everything, and they see you, and a lot of them, the TVs go different places, the fans communicate with each other, and you know, they keep up with it, and a lot of people, so they can recognize you when you talk, or the way you stand in the ring, or the way you walk, or the way you work. You know, fans was pretty smart, and I thought, well, I've been this way, you know, and they thought, well, that might go over, even though it didn't times it, but you got yourself over, you know, pretty good to where you could stay in that. But it was times on it, you know, it just didn't click, you know.
So that, was that your idea, or I know Kelly was looking at the time you came back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kelly, you know, worked on the Mississippi side, and Rocky McGuire was in with Lee there in Mobile, and of course he had Ken Lucas and Dick Don and just different ones on his side. But we was out doing Rocky's side, so Rocky decided to bring me in over there for a few shots in Dothan. I got over there, and a wrestling pro, every time we'd get together in Mobile there or Pensacola, said, man, we was selling out over there, selling out. Got over there, he kept saying about he's selling out, you know, how about the crowd, and I got over there. And my God, you couldn't hit people with a shotgun. I asked Pro, I said, hey, where's all these people that you said you'd been selling out here? Well, I just don't know what happened to them tonight, but I thought to myself, well, you lying dog, you ain't been doing squat. Yeah, every time you get together, you know, you're trying to make yourself. And on top of that, now, I don't know if it's true, it's hearsay, the office, Lee Fields is telling it, that they kept getting letters in there and saying how much they think about bringing the wrestling pro. And it kept on and on and on. Finally, they got to investigating, and it was the pro was sending his own letters into the office and trying to put himself over.
That's what you call pushing yourself, isn't it?
when Lee was getting ready to sell the territory, you know, Barnett out of Atlanta was looking to buy it. This is before Fuller bought it.
Yeah.
And we did a couple of shows down there where he sent some guys from Atlanta down, and then
and had some guys out of the Mobile office come up, and we worked a joint show. One of the places we went was Ozark, Alabama, in the Civic Center over there. And they sent me down there to referee. And I went out there in the first match, and you was talking about hard rings. That's the hardest ring I'd ever been in my life. And I got, and the first match was a couple of guys out of Atlanta. And I went back, I got down on the floor after the match was over, and I looked under there, and it was one of them rings that was designed to have a spring in the middle to give it some give.
Right.
Well, there wasn't no spring under there. They had concrete blocks stacked up. And all the way up to the floor, there was no give whatsoever. So when I got back in the dressing room, I told the guys from Atlanta, I said, look, I said, we got bigger fish to fry. I said, don't nobody go out there and get hurt.
Yeah.
I said, just do what you got to do, but don't get hurt. I said, we're going home tonight, and we'll deal with this later. Well, the pro was there that night, and he was in the next match, and I'd never met him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went out there in the ring, and next thing I know, he was taking bumps off the top rope, and he was doing different stuff, you know. And we got back in the dressing room, and he said, that ring ain't hard. And I'll never forget, I looked at him, I said, bud, there's a lot of difference in being tough and being stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of difference, you know.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, they called him. Come find out. He was writing the letters and everything.
I love it. That's funny.
Everything, and come find out.
Maybe I should have done that.
You mentioned one of the spot places there right out of Mobile one night. And there was me and Billy Spears and I think Bob Kelly, and I don't know for sure. It might have been, Bobby Fields, I believe, or Ken Lucas. Anyhow, was going to work something real hot there, and it was in a National Guard armory. Hot, my Lord, it was hot in there. And people right on top of the ring, and well, about a half a dozen old boys were sitting there. They were sitting there laughing and cutting up, and they were showing out and everything. And the guy who was refereeing was Speedy Hatfield. And Speedy said, keep your eye on that guy there. Said he's fixing to make a entrance. Sure enough, we did something, and they all come in there. We knocked down, drag out, and so that old boy, he was coming. I done had that sucker. I was thinking put him to sleep. I backed up to the rope, and when he got close to me, I didn't see what I had done. My arm had went through the top rope, and I hooked it. And when I started forward, the rope stopped me, took everything out of me. Man, my Lord, I'd hooked the rope there and didn't know anything about it. And I was going to lay that old boy out. Well, finally, we fought away and got to the dressing room. I sat over there. I'd done blowed up. And Spears, he was sitting over there. And old Speedy, he was sitting over on our side, propped up against the wall, smoking a cigarette. I said, man, I said, you know something? I said, that's the first fight I ever in. And the old Speedy cussed. He said, yeah, I could tell the way you was fighting. Man, that old man, I'm telling you the truth, he was a pistol. But, you know, Speedy was one of the best guys I ever seen. I've seen him take guys that couldn't do nothing. And he would work with them and help them with their match, you know, and it's like they'd been in business, you know, for a good while. And there's not many referees that would even help somebody like that. But, you know, it took everybody in the ring to work and try to get something across and lay a foundation of everything, you know. It took everybody. But he was one of them guys, me, and he traveled with me a lot of times going across Mississippi over there. But he was something else. He was one of my best friends there.
He was dangerous,
Rocket,
too.
Rocket Monroe told a story about working somewhere one night, and a guy come in the ring, and Speedy caught him just as he come through the ropes. And just as he come through the ropes, Speedy grabbed him by the hair, and he run his hand around, and he reached through his legs, and he got him by his privates. And he run the guy all the way across the ring, and just as he got to the other side, he gave him privates a little squeeze, and the guy dove right over the top rope. And to the guy sitting on the front row, it looked like Speedy had took this guy and just throwed him right out in the crowd.
And he turned around and he walked back over to where Rocket was doing something. He walked back over and Rocket asked him, said, "Who was that?" Said Speedy looked at him and said, "Oh, it was just some guy passing through."
You remember a guy named Mike Boyette?
Oh, yeah.
Lord, yes.
Yes.
He came down and he was working over there with us on Mississippi side. So Speedy and Billy Spears, Speedy always bad to carry a little bottle with him, you know, take a little nip every once in a while. And so we was in Meridian out there in that old ballpark place there where we dressed at. So him and Spears said, "Let's get this hippie." So Mike was in the dressing room there, and so Speedy and Spears stepped back behind back in there in the shower, and they got into it. Well, old Spears gigged his arm. He hollered out and told Speedy, he said, "Don't cut me, Speedy." And he come out, and his arm was bleeding. Mike Boyette, he come out. Speedy come out, and he was him and Spears was going at it. Old Mike, he backed up. He backed up on through, and he got out his bag, and he left. And he was supposed to be on Pensacola TV the next morning. He went down there, but he went to Lee and told Lee he was giving his notice. they about to run that hippie crazy. So Lee had to get on to Speedy them and told him, said, "Man, don't do that. Leave that guy alone." So, but before the matches and everything started on TV there in Pensacola, Speedy would try to go to Boyette and try to tell him that, hey, he said, "We're just carrying on, you know, hey." He said, "Cuss him out." He said, you stay away from me." He went to Lee and said, "Man, you got my notice. I'm leaving. I'm getting away from them guys." And Speedy was trying to tell him, said, "No, man, hey, we're just working with you." I don't believe that junk. But old Spears, he gigged his arm, and they roughed it up back there behind us in the shower room, and they come out in there, and Speedy told him, said, "Man," said, I cut your insides out." He said, "Me." That hippie's eyes. He went crazy.
Well, we're down to about 3 minutes left.
He come down to Gulfport. He come to Gulfport, and it was hot down there. And I said, "Mike, don't." The crowd's coming, and they're about trying to bust in the door. And I said, "Mike, had a little hole there." I said, "Mike, don't get up there." I said, "I'll have to bust that door in." All of a sudden, he stuck his eye up through that little peephole. There was a fist come through there, bumped up to the guy's elbow, and hit him right between the eyes, knocked him out. Oh, my Lord. Well, I tell you what, we've seen some good times and seen some bad times, you know, and there were some good guys in the territory, went through everywhere. You made a lot of
well, we're down to about 2 minutes left before we sign off. Smitty, I want to ask you about a match that I saw you work. I guess it was November or September, November of 72. You got a shot at Danny Hodge here in Mobile. What was it like working with Mr. Hodge?
Stiff. Stiff. it was good, you know. Hodge, he was very good, but you know, sometimes you get people like that, you know, like a crowbar, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But it turned out good, better than what I thought it would. Everything, but you know, you lock up a guy, and oh, my goodness, this is just like hooking up with a piece of steel. good Lord.
Well, we are out of time for this week, and Curtis, I certainly appreciate you joining us. We'll have to have you back on at some point. And we had a bunch of callers,
anytime.
But I just couldn't get them in. One of them was Charlie Smith, who celebrated a birthday this week, so
uh-huh.
No relation to Curtis, I hope.
Yeah, no. But
Charlie turned 81 for the fifth time in a row this week.
The fifth time.
I know he's listening, so happy birthday, Charlie. And,
happy birthday.
And I said, tomorrow's going to be Dirk's birthday because Bobby Simmons always told me that Charlie was 3 days older than Dirk. So if his birthday was Tuesday, that means Friday is Dirk's birthday. So let's everybody wish a happy birthday to Dirk tomorrow.
Yeah, and, happy birthday, Mr. Dirk.
And that is our show for tonight. And, again, Curtis, I appreciate you joining us. And Bobby and Jerry, as always, enjoyed it. And we'll do this again next week.
Sounds good, guys. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.